Numbers. Numbers play an important role in this, our Passover holiday. Last night, as we sat around the Seder table, after the meal was completed, we played a numbers game. It involved the numbers 1 through 13. And as Father would call out each number, one of us would answer with a pertinent fact respecting that number taken from our wonderful Jewish tradition. Who knew one? One was, of course, the God of the world. Who knew two? Two were the two tables of the covenant, the two tables upon which the tablets of the Ten Commandments were inscribed. Three were Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the great patriarchs of our people. And so we went up in numbers until we reached 13, and so adept have some of our young people become that they can recite each of the 13 in order, fluently, perfectly, and even in the same breath. What a wonderful pedagogic instrument some ancient educator devised when he invented this numbers game. How well and indelibly impressed upon the minds of many a succeeding generation of young Jewish boys and girls, 13 basic cardinal facts taken from Jewish life. We might wish that some of our modern pedagogues could develop the ways and means of equally indelibly impressing upon our young people today the basic facts, say, of grammar, of spelling. Numbers 1 through 13, then, are familiar to us from our Seder ritual. But there are other numbers equally familiar. The number 15. If you look in the introduction to your Haggadah, that wonderfully filled prayer book which retells the story of the deliverance of the Jews from Egypt, which we read through last night, you will see that the service which we read was divided into 15 sections, each one complete in itself, each one an important cog in the total story, in the total moving forward of our Seder ritual. The number 10. The number 10 is familiar to us because it was with 10 plagues that God succeeded in getting Pharaoh to permit the Jews to leave from Egypt. Only after the Egyptians had been afflicted with 10 terrible pestilences would Pharaoh relent and allow Moses to lead the Jewish people from slavery into freedom, from bondage to the service of God. And there is the number 7, the 7 days which this Passover holiday lasts, the 7 days during which we eat only the matzah, the unleavened bread, symbolic of the bread baked in such haste as our ancestors prepared to leave their Egyptian homes to escape into the freedom of a new life. These are some of the numbers associated with our Passover holiday. But there is one number which is preeminently associated with it, which appears again and again and again in the ritual of our Passover and of our Seder, and that is the number 4. Last night, 4 times did we fill our cups of wine. 4 times did we recite the Kiddush. 4 times did we drink of that wine. 4 times did we express our joy to God for the deliverance which he wrought for our people so many thousands of years ago. You will recall that when Moses first returned to Egypt, he did not meet with immediate success. He went before the Pharaoh and pled the cause of the Jews, asked the Pharaoh for permission to lead his people out of Egypt. But Pharaoh would not agree. Indeed, the only immediate results of Moses' first mission was that Pharaoh sent out orders to all the taskmasters, all the slave masters throughout Egypt, that they should double and redouble the burdens and the impositions that they had imposed upon the Jew. And the Jew's lot became doubly difficult because of Moses' plea unto Pharaoh. So much so that the people, the Jews themselves, turned against Moses, and they said, "Have you come to deliver us or to drive us deeper into poverty, into slavery?" So much so that Moses himself came to doubt whether or not his mission had any hope of accomplishment. And in his doubt, he turned to God, And God heard and understood this doubt, and he answered Moses with a fourfold promise. He said, I will deliver this people. I will bring them out of slavery. I will deliver them with a mighty hand. I will take them unto me as my people. And because of this fourfold promise, made good a few days later by God, made good in such a way that our people was enabled to escape from Egypt, to win for themselves a new life. Because of this fourfold promise, because of our rejoicing in the fact of freedom, we lift at the Seder table our cups in joy four times and recite our Kiddush, our praise to God. So the first four of our Passover service has to do with the joy which we feel because of the liberty which our people won so many years ago. But there is another group of four which is equally as important in our Passover story. You know, the Haggadah, which is simply the retelling of the story of the Exodus, is in a sense a book of answers. It is an attempt to answer four questions asked by one of the young people around the table. Four questions which have to do with basic dissimilarities, basic differences between this Seder meal and all other meals or feasts in which we as Jews take part in throughout the year. Why on this night? Why on this night do we do this which is different from all other nights? Why on this night do we eat only unleavened bread? Why on this night do we eat the bitter herb? Why on this night do we dip the parsley, the greenery of spring, into salt water twice? And why on this night did our ancestors eat their Seder meal reclining rather than sitting upright? The Haggadah is an attempt to explain the answers, the reasons for these customs. It's an attempt to underscore basic themes in this Seder ritual as it answers these questions. We eat the unleavened bread because our parents and grandparents, those many thousands of years ago, prepared hastily to leave from Egypt. This was all that they could bake. They had no time to bake for adornment or to bake richly. This was their bread of affliction. And we, sympathizing with the haste with which they were searching for freedom, eat of that bread. Why do we eat the bitter herb? We eat it to remind ourselves that the taste of slavery, the taste of enslavement, the taste of tyranny, the taste of oppression is a bitter one, is a sour taste. It leaves a sour taste in our mouths. And we should never willingly, we who enjoy freedom, we should never willingly accept the yoke of any slave master, of any tyrant, of any oppressor. And why do we dip some green into the salt water? To remind us of the tears which our ancestors shed. To remind us that it was those tears, the effort which they expended, which made possible the deliverance from Egypt, which made possible all the other great accomplishments of our people throughout the ages, and that we, as the latter-day representatives of this great people, people still in an exodus from the slavery of bestiality and of animality to the freedom of maturity, we too should do nothing that would lower our respect in their eyes, which would re-enslave us to our bad habits or to external enemies. And finally, why did our ancestors eat reclining rather than sitting upright? Well, this is a custom which we no longer carry out. But in Roman days, when Rome was master of the world, it was the custom of the Roman nobility to eat this any meal, any feast, in a reclining position. And the Jew, on the great festival and feast day of his year, wanted to eat in a similar position. Tell all men that before God, all men were equal, regardless of the nobility of their birth or the humbleness of their origin. Be they Roman or Jew, master or slave, before God, all men are free and are equal. And in this life, therefore, all men ought to be free and ought to develop a society which permitted equality of opportunity. These are the four questions, and these are the four answers which our Seder Haggadah attempts to retell. So the second four with which we deal tells us the meaning of our Passover story. But I would call your attention to the fact that there is a third four written into the message and the purpose of this Passover season. Almost at the beginning of our Haggadah, they tell the story of four sons, four basic types of people who come to the Seder table and there ask the question of the leader of the evening, of the father, of the master of the house, ask the question why this Seder is being observed. And the answer to which the rabbis gave to each of these four men, each of these four sons, emphasizes the psychology of the Seder. The four questions emphasize the philosophy of the Seder, the four sons, its psychology. There is the Chacham, the wise man, the understanding and discerning son. To him you should reveal all the subtleties, all the nuances, all the fine shadings of ideas which are involved in our Bible and in the Haggadah and in this whole theme of liberty and the responsibilities of freedom. There is the Rasha, the cynical son, the scoffing son. To him you should simply emphasize the fact and the truth of the Passover. You should not attempt to argue with him, to rationalize your own beliefs for his benefits, but simply to state as a belief your unfailing and unswerving allegiance to the basic principles which this Passover holiday emphasizes. There is the Tum, the simple son, the man or the woman who will never understand beyond the broad outlines, the basic facts of the story. And you should see to it as you retell this story that these bold facts stand out in relief, are readily apparent, so that any, however simple, can grasp them and understand them. And finally, there is the Eino Yodea Lishol, the uneducated man, the illiterate person, the person who has not yet had an opportunity to gain a background, the basic facts behind the Seder story. This person you should have patience with, and you should bit by bit explain to him the history of the Exodus, the 40 years of wandering in the desert, the meaning of freedom and of liberty in the lives of all men, its importance in our day. You should not begrudge the time you spend with such a person, for there is a thirst for learning here, and you must be prepared to gratify it. These are the four types which appear at our Seder table. They appear in our classrooms, they appear in our temples, they appear wherever men try to educate others into the basic facts which are precious to them, the basic moral ideas which are fundamental in their ways of life. And anyone who would attempt to teach others things precious to him should concern himself with knowing the personalities of those scholars who sit before him, and not simply teach the facts baldly as he thinks they might be taught. There is then a profound psychology which any who would lead the Seder are advised to develop. There is a profound philosophy which any who take part in the Seder are asked to consider. And there is a profound rejoicing on this Passover day which tells us that we should consider ourselves as if we too had been delivered from Egypt, as if we too were enjoying for the first time the heady wine of freedom and reveling in this exaltation. The freedom which we enjoy should become most precious to us. We should begrudge any person or any group or any philosophy which would take the smallest iota of this freedom from us. These fours remind us of the tonic of our Passover holiday. And finally, I would call your attention to another four, another grouping of four with which you are perhaps not so familiar, but one which also tells us a great deal about the basic meaning of this holiday. This group of four appears not in the Haggadah, not in the prayer book from which we read this morning, but in the Midrash, in that basic collection of elucidations and explanations on our Bible which our rabbis wrote through the long centuries. They tell the story that when the Jews left Egypt, they left feeling that the great deliverance had truly come. They could see no obstacles to their escape from Egypt, to their rebuilding a peoplehood, a nationhood in their desert, and to the developing for themselves and for their children and for their grandchildren a way of life of which they would be immensely proud. But almost immediately, you will recall from the Bible, Pharaoh relented and decided to reverse his promise to allow the Jews to go free. And he dispatched his best chariot regiment to pursue the Jew and to bring them back into Egypt. The Jewish rear guard, according to this midrash, saw the dust rising from underneath the wheels of Pharaoh's chariots just as they approached the Red Sea. They brought the news of this pursuit into the camp, and there was great alarm, there was great clamor and confusion and consternation. Before them was an impassable, unfordable sea. Behind them now were the pursuing enemies who had gone back on their promise. On each side was a barren wilderness which no man could traverse. No one knew where to turn. They were faced with a great problem. And according to the Midrash, the Jews then spread into four different camps, each camp having a separate counsel or advice which they would impose upon all. One group cautioned, "Let us go back to Egypt. Let us fly the white flag of surrender as Pharaoh's chariots appear. Let us tell them that we will abjectly follow them back to Pithom and to Ramses, to all of these store cities which we were building, and there return to our tasks, there bend our heads again under the yoke of slavery." These were all the timid men of the camp, all the cowardly men, all those who throughout their lives had, whenever an obstacle opposed them, willingly submitted to superior force. All those who had never once dared in their lives to stand up and to be counted for something which they deemed important or precious. A second group of men were, our Midrash tells us, unwilling to return to slavery, but they were filled with the blackness of despair. They could see no hope, no out. They could not even cast about in their minds for any solution to this difficulty which surrounded them. And so they advised Moses that the whole Jewish people should simply cast themselves into the sea and there drown, there commit suicide. They felt hopeless in this life. The only hope which they saw was in some future promise, and they would now cash in on that promise. Here were all those who are the pessimists of life, who easily despair whenever faced with any major problem, who give up before the problem has really presented itself and before they have explored all the possible avenues of solution. There was yet a third group, a group of men who became completely unnerved and unbalanced by the danger in which they were placed. They ran about hither and yer, helter-skelter, pell-mell. And finally, they hit upon this idea as a solution to their dilemma. They said, "Let all the Jews come together to some central place. And there, as Pharaoh's chariots approach, that the Jews begin to shout aloud. Perhaps the noise of their shouting will so confuse Pharaoh and his charioteers that they will turn back and we will be free." Now, there is obviously no hope in some such solution, but there are many who go through life and who, whenever they are faced with a serious problem, some issue of grave concern, become unnerved and unbalanced by it, and cease to think reasonably or rationally, and pin their hopes upon harebrained schemes which have not a single possibility of success. And finally, a fourth group counseled Moses that he should immediately attack the enemy that was pursuing. As they were busy about shining their armor, buckling on their swords, this group of men would told Moses that he should rush out into battle. They should brave the spears and the swords of Pharaoh's hosts. Perhaps in an immediate attack, there lay some salvation. Here were joined all the men who, at a slightest provocation in their lives, respond by the use of force. all the combative, all the pugnacious, all the irenic people of this world, who look to no other solution than that of force, even when that solution offers no hope. How profound was the understanding of human nature which our rabbis expressed when they told of these four camps into which the Jews divided. Because how often when we are faced with some serious problem do we resort to one or another of these four solutions or pseudo-solutions. Sometimes we play the part of the craven, of the coward. Before even the enemy is upon us, before the danger is with us, we fly the white flag. We surrender without attempting to achieve our salvation. Sometimes we become so overwhelmed with despondency and with despair and with gloom that we cease to cast about for some hope. We give up. We look to some preacher of salvation, some gospel of the afterlife as our only hope. And we simply deny the problems which surround us in this world. And sometimes we pin our hopes on schemes which have no hope of realization. Our minds run away with ourselves. They become unbalanced. And we destroy ourselves with schemes that could never come to reality. And sometimes we buckle on the armor of battle when we have no reason to do battle, and we will simply be overwhelmed by a host too superior for us, when it would have been the better part of valor to have been cautious and to have sought some other avenue of solution. Fortunately, Moses and the leaders of Israel took none of these four counsels. We do not know what transpired so many thousands of years ago. The sands of time have run so full that our vision of those days is clouded. But we do know that they achieved the miracle of deliverance. They persisted in their determined effort to find a way to free this people. And that because of their persistence, the miracle of deliverance became reality. How so? I think it became so because above all else, they pinned their faith in the last of the fours basic to this holiday, in the four letters which in Hebrew spell out the name of God, Adonai. They put their faith in God. They adopted some reasonable plan which had a hope of success. They worked to achieve that. They worked in confidence, in faith, that God would make good his promise, that God would see to it that those dedicated to his service would not suffer for their dedication. So it must be with us. Whenever we are faced with a serious life problem, let us avoid the way of the coward. Let us avoid the way of the defeatist. Let us avoid the way of the unbalanced. Let us avoid the way of the pugnacious. Let us find hope in our God. And out of that hope, let us build for ourselves a plan of action, reasonable, efficacious, one which will lead to the success, to the happy solution which we desire. Faith will give us hope. Hope will give us courage and strength. And where there is hope, where there is courage, where there is strength, there is the miracle of deliverance. Amen.